Warning, this podcast contains heavy spoilers for not just one movie, but entire franchises. We highly recommend going and watching these movies before listening to us as a companion piece that stitches all the timelines into one creepy, crime-ridden story. There will be no more spoiler warnings. We do not break character. After this, there is no turning back. You've been warned. Hit the music.
You are talking about the nonsensical ravings of a lunatic mind.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Looking for a quiet, remote family getaway? Look no further than the newly renovated Overlook Hotel. With our famous garden maze and beautifully appointed interiors, there's a surprise around every corner. Our staff is hard at work to make you feel welcome. The Overlook Hotel. Come stay with us forever and ever.
So based on that lovely ad I just played for you, how likely are you to go stay at the Overlook Hotel?
Very likely.
Yeah?
Yes.
Well, prepare for the Yelp review from hell as I drag you through the historic halls of the supposedly haunted Overlook Hotel. Hello and welcome to It's Alive Alive podcast. This is a true crime paranormal interstellar podcast covering unbelievable stories that sound like they were ripped straight from the pages of a Hollywood script. I'm your host, a man of many names, the outlaw Harley Ray, the bruiser Bronson, Dr. H. Joe Smokestein, THE, or you can just call me Josh for short. And with me as always is my very own Scream Queen, the perfect combination of beauty and brains, the bride of Smokestein, the India Horror, the expert of guts and gore, the gorgeous, the sexy Amy Rose.
Hi.
And if you haven't guessed, this week we are doing haunted hotels. One haunted hotel in particular.
Nice. I love paranormal stuff, and creepy hotels are the best. Like, you have to imagine that it's pretty common for people to die, like, between, like, in hotel rooms, between old age, health issues, and unfortunately homicide and suicide.
Yeah, sure, remember my story about working in the Cahernan Hotel in Killarney, where the ghost of the original owner's daughter, Gwendolyn Herbert, is still said to roam. No, I never saw her or anything. I was just told, like, that she roamed around the area where I was painting the
before most. Or after you were painting?
Oh, well, she'd been there for years.
No, I mean, were you told before?
I was
after?
Told before. I completely forgot about it. And then I would just spent my whole time listening to the last podcast and left on my headphones. So I never actually
heard
paid anything. Any attention to anything that was going on around me, bar my painting and podcast.
Yeah.
Well, could have been there, don't know.
It is a well-known fact. Ireland is home to some of the scariest and most disturbing ghost stories you'll ever hear, some of which originate and remain in hotels scattered all over the country. So if you've ever had the urge to scare yourself and are fascinated by paranormal stories that run rampant on the Emerald Isle, then there's here's a look at some of Ireland's most haunted hotels. Number one is Ballycally Castle in County Antrim. Perched along Northern Ireland's famous Causeway coastal route, this majestic hotel is said to have been the scene of strange apparitions. One of the most memorable stories to come out of the Ballygally Castle is... That's really hard to say, yep, Ballygally Castle.
I was the same. That's because we have Ballygarry Hotel here. Which
I think that's...
No, we don't get to that.
We've got Ballygarry in Tip as well. Yeah, it should be. Ballygally Castle Hotel is that of Lady Isabella Shaw. She is said to have lived a tragic life, having been locked in a tower by her own husband, Lord James Shaw, due to her inability to give birth to a male heir. Isabella is said to have fallen to her death on the rocks below her window after she slipped trying to escape her prison. She is said to roam the hallways in search of her baby daughter. Visitors and staff at the Ballygally Castle Hotel have reported strange phenomena such as unexplained noises, doors opening and closing by themselves, and unusual sensations.
You have to admit, as a people, we have come a long way. I mean, when you look at the fact that this guy was like, you are not giving me a son, I am locking you up, you are imprisoned. Like, but is it not the sperm
that decides whether it's going to be fucking male or female anyway? So it's the man, it's the male genetics.
The time there was just women sitting there, like, after sex, with their, doing all those stupid things you hear, like, those old timey things, like, if you keep your legs up in the air and all that kind of shit. Think they're, like, doing that and, like, fingers crossed in their head, they're just, be a boy, 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 be a boy.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially if you were, like, nobility, like.
No, it would just be a boy, be a boy, be a boy, be a boy, be a boy.
But imagine, that must be awful, that disappointment. It's that you're like, oh, shit. Number two then is Cabra Castle in County Cavan. Cabra Castle is undoubtedly one of Ireland's most haunted hotels. The chateau, now converted into a 4-star hotel, has been the scene of numerous ghostly apparitions in the past. And it has to be said, whether you're a skeptic or a believer, the place is charged with a strange atmosphere. Tragic events and local legends that have persisted through the generations are just some of the reasons why Cabra Castle might be haunted. One of the most intriguing stories surrounding Cabra Castle goes back centuries. The story that a former castle servant named Sarah had a secret love affair with the owner's son. When the family discovered this... I know, yeah. When the family discovered the relationship, their anger was so intense that they ordered Sarah's execution. According to legend, she was taken from her room in the middle of the night and led to a forest where she was thrown off a bridge. The tragedy of this story, marked by the violent death of Sarah and her unborn child, has left a dark imprint and potentially residual energy. That's a really hard word to say as well. My mouth tonight. Residual energy on the castle walls. Over the years, visitors to Cabra Castle have reported hearing strange noises, babies crying, and even heart-rending screams at night. These testimonials have reinforced the belief that Sarah's tormented soul continues to haunt the places where she met such a tragic end. What's more, Cabra Castle is imbued with a romantic Gothic atmosphere, with its imposing towers, dark corridors, and winding staircases. The visual ambience adds to the perception that the chateau is a place where the veil between the world of the living and that of the spirits is particularly thin. Visitors are often captivated by the castle's mournful beauty, but this unique aesthetic can also contribute to tales of paranormal phenomena.
Now, this list is very good with its ghost stories.
It is.
But I'm starting to see the fact that they snuck a little lad in there for each of these hotels as they go along.
I feel like I'm plugging hotels, Josh. I have visions of me doing those, like, silly, like, infomercials, and it's just the woman in the corner with the, like, the hotel zooming in and out.
But the ghost stories are good.
Yeah. Number three on the list is Markree Castle in County Sligo. Where did you get this list?
Wow.
Google. Markree Castle in Ireland is said to be haunted by the ghost of a little girl. Known as Pippa, the young girl would make regular appearances at the hotel. Staff members and visitors have told stories explaining that the girl would have fun locking people in their rooms. She'd play mischievous tricks on them, laughing out loud throughout the corridor and rooms of the castle. Reports of strange noises, inexplicable sensations, and fleeting apparitions contribute to the idea that the castle is inhabited by invisible presences. The picturesque setting of Markree Castle, with its vast grounds and historic buildings, adds to the mysterious atmosphere that surrounds it. Visitors find themselves transported to bygone eras where ghost stories and mysteries seem to come alive among the stone walls and dark corridors.
I'll take the music from the clip of the Overlook Hotel ad that I had at the start and I'm going to put it over these little sections that you're talking
about.
But I'm not saying in that one, I don't like... little kid, especially girl kids, ghosts, and we're going to learn why in episode 2 of this series.
I don't know if they're on this list, but there is a hotel in Ireland where there is two girls, they were twins, and it's a castle hotel, but basically one died, but one fell down the stairs, but the ghosts that come back, one of them is like dragging her broken legs like down behind her back down the stairs.
That's fucked up.
It's creepy. Number four on this list is Wilton Castle in County Wexford. Wilton Castle in Ireland is a building full of stories and spooky apparitions. Set in picturesque surroundings, this historic castle is said to be haunted by a figure known as Harry Alcock. His ghost, who died in the 19th century, is said to be seen regularly in the Wilton Castle area. Local legends have it that at certain times every year, locals would gather to try and catch a glimpse of its ghostly silhouette. But he wouldn't be the only ghost to appear in the castle. A former actress is also said to haunt the premises, and it is said that this spirit illuminates the castle tower.
I wonder who that is. That'd be interesting. We've got to look that up.
Only thing that I could find about that was that she was a former actress that died in old age, and she died when her eye when her oil lamp lit up her skirt.
Ooh.
Yeah, so she burned to death.
Yikes.
Yes.
That was the dangers before electricity.
Oh, come here. It happened a whole lot. There is this one story as well where people, where this church burned down and people were running to the door. But there was a massive door jam caused by all the women running to the door and all their skirts. Yeah. And nobody could get out of the door and they all burned to death. At number five, one of my personal favorites is Kinnity Castle in County Offaly. Kinnity Castle has a strange ghost story. A monk would make repeated appearances, creating fear among the local population. This mysterious figure has been observed in physical form interacting with castle staff and visitors. These enigmatic encounters have reinforced the belief that spirits from the past linger within the walls of this hotel. In addition to the ghost monk, two specific rooms at Kinnity Castle, the Geraldine Room and the Elizabeth Room, have acquired a reputation for paranormal apparitions. Testimonials report unexplained apparitions, strange noises and unusual sensations in these rooms.
And you want us to get married there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be my number one place, is Kinnity Castle.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
Only if we could get the week so that we could go spooking around the place for
they
a while.
They let you use the sword as well to cut your cake.
Oh,
see, that yeah, that'd be cool. Out.
We have one here in Tralee as well, close to where we live, and it is in Ballyseedie Castle, County Kerry, not to be confused with the Ballyseedie meth cartel. The mystery and magic that surround Ballyseedie's castle have fueled many theories and speculations in the past right up to present day. The ancestral castle, now converted into a hotel, is a fabulous place with its imposing towers and dramatic stories.
Good job. It's very hard to stay in character, isn't it?
One of the most memorable stories associated with the site is that of Hilda Blennerhasseth, a member of the family who owned the castle from the 18th century until her death in 1965. I didn't realize it was that recent. It is said that Hilda's spirit still wanders the castle corridors and grand staircases, perpetuating the presence of her past and heritage. Visitors and staff at Ballyseedie Castle have reported strange sensations and unusual experiences. Fleeting apparitions, doors that open and close by themselves, and mysterious noises have been reported on several occasions. That's not a good actual plug for the hotel, because you don't really want that to be happening in your hotel. You want peace and quiet.
Did you know, though, that when Hilda, that during lockdown, visitors, I think there's a picture of it as well, they caught a woman in Victorian clothing in one of the windows. But apparently when Hilda died, she was found in an old black Victorian dress.
These phenomena have contributed to the belief that the chateau is inhabited by invisible presences. What's more, the medieval atmosphere of Ballyseedie Castle creates an ideal backdrop for ghost stories and supernatural intrigue. Hanging chandeliers, dark corridors and elegant rooms reinforce the idea that the chateau retains ancient secrets and residual energies from the past. All that, and it doesn't even come close to the subject we're about to cover today, and that is the Overlook Hotel.
I'd probably get married there as well. But before we get into that, if you liked that little rundown of haunted hotels, then come check out my show, Creepypasta Crypt, every Monday and Tuesday. There's about 50-odd episodes up, and a good shot of them are ghost and haunting related.
Yeah, she won't ghost you if you listen to them. She'll talk to you, actually, if you talk to her online. She's really nice.
Yeah.
But good plug.
Thank you.
The Overlook Hotel began construction in 1907 in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. The passion project of 40-year-old oil tycoon Robert Townley Watson, a man who had gone from rags to riches. Born in 1867, Watson's father was an aspiring gold miner who moved the family of Robert, his younger sister Helen, and mother Regina to the Rockies in search of riches. At this point in American history, Colorado was heavily populated by Native Americans. Native Americans who still weren't too happy that these Brits were coming in and commandeering their land. Living in makeshift campsites, Robert's days consisted of fishing, hunting, collecting firewood, and helping his father in search for gold, all while fending off the angry Injuns, as he put it in his own autobiography years later. Robert didn't exactly have a great respect for the natives and actually held a bit of a vendetta against them, which we will see later. He was 8 when they moved and begun the search for Colorado gold. They spent 10 years at it with little to no success. Yeah, they'd find the odd tiny nugget, but enough to pay for some supplies and keep the family motivated, but never the big one. Well, not until 1885 anyway. According to Robert, he and his father had been getting close. They could feel it. Then one hot July day, they did it. They struck gold.
What do you mean struck gold? I thought that you used like a sieve, like a pan to search rivers.
What, like you would put it in and
shake it around a bit. Yeah, like a sieve. Like.
They were searching for gold in the river, but Robert, getting frustrated with the day's events, it had been another dud of a day, one of many that they had been having, picked up a pickaxe that he had leaning against a tree and drove it into the ground in anger, and out it came. Black gold.
So they struck oil?
Yep, sure okay. did. But what should have been a day of celebration for the Watsons soon became tragedy. Bill Watson sent his son to alert the family and relevant officials so that he could stake his claim. Meanwhile, he would stay behind and guard their newly found nest egg. Unfortunately, upon his return with his mother, sister and family solicitor...
Why do they have a family solicitor? I thought they were broke living in a campsite.
Well, this has been 10 years. They had upgraded to a shack now and there were no members of the small Colorado community.
Okay.
Anyway, upon their return, they found the body of Bill drowned in oil and scalped. It didn't take long for Robert to round up a posse of men with his new fortune as motivation. The men knew they would be well compensated. Robert and his mercenaries tracked down the local Native American tribe, slaughtering the whole clan, men, women and children alike, scalping each alive before burying them all alive in a mass grave. Archaeologists eventually dug up the remains for examination, in which 30 men, 28 women and 13 children were all found to have been bound and gagged before burial. The site of this massacre and mass grave would later become the site of Robert Watson's masterpiece, The Overlook Hotel. Now, when I say Watson had a vendetta against the natives, I mean it. This massacre on the Overlook site was just the beginning of what I can only describe as the native genocide of the Rocky Mountains. As I said already, this area of America was still heavily populated with Native Americans. Natives who wanted revenge against Watson and were more than pissed off that he disrespected their dead by building a hotel over their bodies for the very people that were responsible for destroying their land. The Overlook was to be a lavish, exclusive, high-class resort for the mega-rich, famous, and even royalty. So what had originally planned to be a year-long build, which started in 1907, turned into two, as the natives repeatedly mounted attack after attack on the building and its workers. Watson, tiring of the constant setbacks and mounting costs with rebuilds and payouts to injured or, in some cases, dead workers' families, decided it was time to go full Nazi and wipe the natives from his land once and for all. So again, using his riches, Watson paid mercenaries, bounty hunters and ex-soldiers to eradicate the native scourge from his life. Now, remember the difference in money between now and the early 1900s.
Mm.
But Watson was offering for his mercenaries 100 per head, 1,000 per clan and 10,000 for any man who was able to scare the natives away for good. The 10,000 was never claimed. Although it is said over the 2 years it took to build the Overlook, Watson paid out up to $100,000 to bounty hunters. And although they weren't scared off the land, the natives' numbers were decimated enough for them to withdraw and admit defeat, allowing the Overlook to open its doors in 1909. And although they did continue to pick away at Watson, his hotel, his staff and guests, as people related to the hotel would go missing from time to time, until Watson's sold the hotel in 1929.
Okay.
In the 20 years Watson owned the hotel, it was a hotspot for celebrity socialites and on a few occasions even royalty. Regular guests included Henry Ford and his family, Jean Harlow, as well as Clark Gable and Carol Lombard.
Do I know her? She was married to Clark Gable. Her story always makes me a bit sad. She was married twice, Clark Gable, but they were seen as like, you know, like a great romance. Married him in 1939 after she divorced her husband. They were trying to have kids, but it turned up that she was infertile. And then she went on a war bonds tour in 1942 and she was traveling back on the plane and died at the age of 33. Yeah. But apparently Clark Gable never got over her. It was a proper romance.
Anyway, as I was saying before Amy depressed us all.
Sorry. Like you're not about to depress us.
No, it was a nice little story. It's not a nice little story. It's a terrible story, but it's a Interesting story. As I was saying, it was the perfect getaway for the super rich and famous who were sick of the adoring fans and constant hounding for autographs and pictures. Would they get pictures at that time?
I don't know. I mean, I presume you'd want to have a bit of money yourself to be able to have a camera that you could walk around with back then.
I mean, I just added the pictures in there. I write the script for this stuff, so I mean, it was like autographed pictures, what you'd be avoiding. But like, did they have photographs back then? So probably just autographs. But yeah. I don't know. I wasn't around back then. Even though I have seen some photographs online of people claiming that they're old photographs of people holding iPhones and stuff like that in like the 30s and 40s and stuff.
Yeah, these days can't be anything.
We got fucking AI, fucking they can make anything we want now. So
yeah, but I mean that white rectangle could be anything.
Oh, I know that. I'm just saying I could go on an AI app right now. Say put iPhone in man from 50s hand and I would get a picture of a man dressed like he is from the 50s holding an iPhone.
That's true.
It's not that hard anymore.
No.
Anyway, although to the outside world, the Overlook Hotel looked to be a thriving exclusive resort for only the world's elite, Watson was suffering as the hotel hemorrhaged money. You see, the location chosen for its seclusion was impossible to reach during the treacherous Colorado winter months, meaning the Overlook was a seasonal resort, closing at the end of September, start of October, and reopening in May each year. This gave Watson 5 to 6 months to squeeze every penny he could from his popular residence.
So surely he was cleaning up on the celebrities every year.
Yeah, but the Overlook cost a fortune to maintain. The place took a battering over the winter and needed a shit ton of repairs every year. The roof alone was replaced 5 times during Watson's tenure.
That would piss me off.
Oh, me too.
Shit time for new roof.
The final nail in the coffin for Watson and the Overlook happened in March 1929 when the stock market crashed, decimating Watson's wealth and forcing him to sell his beloved Overlook to a group of investors at a loss. The hotel went on to change hands many times from 1929 to 1940, each new owner with a dream to restore the hotel to its former glory. But unfortunately, the place seemed cursed, and each new owner only lasted a few months before putting the Overlook back on the market. With declining interest came declining maintenance, and as the months became years, the Overlook looked destined to fade into history, a ghostly structure stuck in the middle of the Rocky Mountains. That was until a man by the name of Horace DeWent got his hands on it, with grand plans to not just restore the Overlook to Watson's original glory, but to improve on it and make it the most exclusive, lavish hotel in history, where the elite could come to live out their deepest and darkest sexual desires. Ooh. Giggity. Hey kids, can't get enough of that blood, guts and gore? Then head on over to our Patreon, where for just $5 a month you'll get exclusive access to our true crime show Real Monsters and horrific history tales from Playing with Bones with Amy Rose, along with early access to our minisodes and ad-free access to everything else. All this and loads more horror-tastic extras from the Horrorverse. So what are you waiting for? Permission? Go nick your parents' card today and subscribe now at patreon.com/ It's Alive Alive Pod. Remember, that's It's Alive Alive Podcast, a really, really fake true crime horror podcast. It's Alive Alive, all the guts and gore with none of the guilt.
So this was a pure pleasure palace, like a place where celebs and politicians could live out their kinks.
I said that's what DeWent's plan was. I didn't say he succeeded. I mean, he held a few key parties, had a few wide shut nights, but all in all, it was pretty tame. Far from the Jesus the sad vision he originally had.
Who's Jesus the sad?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm getting into this subject. Jesus the sad, real name unknown, adopted his stage name by putting the name of Jesus Christ and the surname of Marquis de Sade together in a blasphemous mixture of sacred and profane, just the way he liked it. This man's entire life was dedicated to pleasure in its most extreme forms. He believed San Francisco to be the new biblical Gomorrah and wanted to make the best use of it in his life. He founded and directed the Gomorrah people, appointing himself as their lord, and used his considerable wealth and social status to finance every forbidden sick perversion, the more revolting the better. He became famous or infamous for drug dealing and producing and starring in some extreme porn films, for his sick sexual tastes, and of course for hosting the best and most sinful parties San Francisco had ever seen. Providing forbidden pleasures granted the sad an increasing number of hosts, while in turn knowing powerful people's dirty little secrets increased his powers and influence, in turn making him one of the most powerful men in the city and in the entire West Coast of America. He had many servants who helped him manage his empire of vice, and most efficient of them being Harcourt, met on the set of one of his porn movies, Sex Dwarf, and hired as on retainer from there on. Harcourt found lubricant for Desaad's hosts, found actors and actresses for his movies, managed his finances, and raided the local zoo to provide Jesus with always different animals to satisfy his thirst for exotic sex. From big mammals to gerbils to armadillos. Armadillos. That was Jesus Desaad. I'm pretty sure he had an armadillo. His empire of boundless hedonism crumbled down within a single day in quite an unexpected way. Jesus Desaad was hosting one of his legendary parties, a never-ending orgy with dozens of people invited, when three unexpected guests crashed it. A priest, Jesse Custer, his girlfriend Tulip, and their friend Cassidy. The trio had come to Desaad's mansion while investigating the death of Greta, Cassidy's girlfriend, killed by a heroin overdose. The drug had come from Desaad. At first, the three party crashers were quite amused with what they found in Desaad's mansion, and the lord of the Gomorrah people even invited them to join his guests. While snooping around the mansion, however, Jesse found and said the set of the new porn film Desaad was filming, one that involved a young boy among others. Disgusted by his host's pedophilia, Jesse reached Desaad and started beating him savagely, as we would all fucking do. In the meantime, some agents of the Grail, don't worry, I'll get to it, had followed Custer and his friends and started a shootout that made all the guests escape in fear. So there was nobody left to defend the master hedonist. Nobody but the always faithful Harcourt, who tried to save his lord by pointing a gun at Custer. Without even stopping, reducing the Sad's face to a bloody pulp, Custer used the voice of command, again, I'll get to it, to order Harcourt to eat his gun, something he tried to do, breaking his teeth and jaw in the process. Desaad was left alive, but definitely not well. Custer compelled the porn actress to denounce everything that went on in the house to the police, having the Lord of Gomorrah people arrested. And, went to jail for a while. But prison was not the worst thing that could happen to Jesus Desaad, however, because Jesse Custer, in fact, promised he would wait for the moment he got out of jail to personally inflict him with some true punishment.
Okay. Great. That answers the question of who Jesus Desaad is, but I have a follow-up question, and that's, what's the Grail, and how did the priest force a guy to eat a gun without physically forcing it down his throat?
Awesome. Well, okay, right. You ready? The Grail is a clandestine organization with holdings and agents from 113 countries under the guise of Grail Industries. The Grail is tasked with to protect the bloodline of Christ, and for over two millennia, the Grail worked hand in hand with heaven and hell. Their ultimate goal is to facilitate the apocalypse through nuclear warfare and pave the way of Humperdew to take over as the Messiah.
Humperdew.
Yeah, Jesus Messiah, keep up. Now, Jesse Custer is a priest who's looking for God, and he's going to kick his ass because he...
No, I'm going to stop you right there. Like, I had enough conspiracy talk with the Trioxin series. Move on with Derwent.
Okay. But it's just about to get interesting.
Oh, fuck it. I'll change the subject then. Like, you compared Derwent to Jesus Desaad, but as far as I know, Jesus operated in the 90s. Derwent most likely modeled himself after the Marquis Desaad. Marquis de Sade, originally Donatien Alphonse François, Count de Sade, born in 1740 in France and died about 18, I think in 1814 near Paris, was a French novelist and philosopher. After abandoning a military career at the end of the Seven Years' War, he married and became involved in a life of debauchery and outrageous scandal with prostitutes and with local young people that he abducted, for which he was repeatedly imprisoned and once narrowly escaping execution. Despite his noble birth, he supported the French Revolution, which he saw as representing political liberation on a level parallel to the sexual liberation he himself represented. He was twice sent to this insane asylum at Charenton, where he would eventually die. He overcame boredom and anger in prison and the asylum by writing sexually graphic novels and plays. The 120 Days of Sodom, written in 1785, was a tale of four libertines who kidnap victims for a non-stop orgy of perversion. In his most famous novel, Justine, in 1791, the heroine suffers because she fails to perceive that there is no moral God and that desire is the only reality. His other works included Philosophy in the Bedroom in 1793 and Crimes of Passion in 1800. His reputation and writings gave rise to the term sadism.
Do you know what we should do? Do you know when Channel 4, Americans won't know this, Channel 4 is a British channel, but they did this thing where shows swapped what they were doing. So like you had 8 out of 10 Cats did Countdown.
Oh yeah, yeah, I remember
and
that.
And stuff
yeah.
like that. And that's still a running show, yeah. 8 out of 10 does Cats Countdown, which was so popular.
So popular, yeah.
But what we should do some week is we should swap shows. And you should do Real Monsters and I do the Marquis de Sade. Mm-hmm. And I will do Playing with Bones and I'll cover some Viking shit.
Oh, yeah.
Do a little flip over one week.
Okay.
So we're Playing with Bones does Real Monsters and Real Monsters does Playing with Bones.
Okay, cool. I got to approve the script though.
Huh?
I got to approve the script.
Oh, God. Derwent, a millionaire inventor, pilot, film producer, and entrepreneur, and a known bisexual man in a time where homosexuality could result in serious jail time, liked to flaunt his debaucherous lifestyle to the invited guests of the Overlook Hotel.
How did he get away with being openly bi at the time?
Wealth status, and he never entered into a relationship with other men. He enjoyed sleeping with men, but that's where the fascination ended. When it came to relationships, he was all about the women, and there was no shortage of them in his life either.
So he never had a boyfriend, like not even a secret one?
Not that I know of, but there is an interesting story about one of Derwent's flings falling head over heels for the former movie producer turned hotel owner. Apparently, just before reopening the hotel, Horace had a fling with a gay man named Roger while on a trip to Cuba. Like most holiday romances, for Horace, the relationship ended at the end of the weekend. But for Roger, the weekend meant a whole lot more. Becoming infatuated by the charismatic millionaire, Roger dropped everything in his life and moved to Colorado to show Horace his dedication to him and in hopes of changing his no-gay dating policy. But the man he met in Colorado was a vast contrast to the one he had spent time with in Cuba.
Like Danny and Sandy in Greece.
Similar.
Okay.
The once tender and romantic lover from Cuba was now cold and abusive towards his persistent admirer, essentially showing his dominance to his elite guests as he humiliated Roger in their presence. Horace held so much power over Roger that he only agreed to let Roger stay at the Overlook if he dressed and acted, and I quote, as a doggy. For months, Roger paraded around the Overlook dressed as a dog, staying in character at all times out of fear that if he disobeyed his master, he would be exiled and sent away from the man he adored so much.
How long did this go on for?
Apparently, Roger died under suspicious circumstances sometime in the late 40s. Official cause of death is he choked to death on some food, but rumour has it that while performing oral sex on Derwent, Derwent held him by a dog choker leash. The closer he came to climax, the more he tightened the leash. By the time the deed was done, Roger was dead on the floor of room 217.
Never investigated.
Not a thing. It was hidden so deep that I can't even find a last name for Roger to this day. In his attempt to design the greatest hotel in the world, Derwent spent in and around $3 million on hotel renovations that would be about $34-35 million in today's money. These mountain costs, along with his lavish lifestyle, along with what was becoming a full-blown obsession with the hotel, saw Derwent turn down outside projects in favour of spending more time in the Overlook, often spending winters alone with only contracted maintenance workers to keep him company.
This guy must have had an endless supply of cash the way he's spending a living.
Afraid not. And in 1952, the well ran dry, but some new investors were on hand and happy to help. Those investors were the New York-based Paglieri Investment Group, otherwise known as the Paglieri crime family. The Overlook Hotel had often been used as a neutral meeting ground for the New York and surrounding area crime families. Its seclusion, along with its one-way in, one-way-out road system, provided them with plenty of safety and warning from outside threats, namely Johnny Law. It's even the location of the legendary meeting that saw the birth of the Commission, and essentially the birth of the modern U.S. Mafia. The Commission is the governing body of the American Mafia, formed in 1931 by Charles Lucky Luciano following the Castellammarese War. The Commission replaced the title of Capo di Tutti e Capi, meaning the boss of all bosses, held by Salvatore Maranzano before his murder, with a ruling committee that consists of the bosses of the five families of the New York City Mafia, as well as the bosses of the Chicago outfit and, at various times, the leaders of smaller families such as Buffalo, Philadelphia, Detroit, and others. The purpose of the commission was to oversee all mafia activities in the United States and serve to mediate conflicts amongst families. Essentially running their crime gangs like any other high-functioning business, the very definition of organized crime. One of these mobsters took a particular shine to the hotel, becoming a seasonal live-in guest, spending his entire summers in the Overlook luxury suite. This was Paglieri crime family underboss Vittorio Gianelli. Gianelli, the brother-in-law of Don Salvatore Paglieri, hadn't had the same rough upbringing as his peers and had a lot felt that he had held his position due to nepotism rather than on merit. Gianelli, more of a white-collar criminal than a blue, had a tendency to look down his nose on some of the more brutish members of the family. This led to a lot of unrest when Salvatore eventually passed away of old age, leaving control of the family to Gianelli. In the meantime, the mounting costs of the Overlook forced the Wendt to take out loans to keep things together. Those loans were acquired from, you guessed it, Vittorio Gianelli. It doesn't take a genius to figure out what happened next, and as Derwent fell deeper and deeper into debt, ownership of the Overlook eventually found its way into the hands of Gianelli, and so began the age of the Mafia in the Overlook Hotel. From 1953 to 1967, the Overlook was pretty much a mob safe haven. The original plan was to make a casino resort out of the hotel, but strict gambling laws saw that plan go the way of the dodo. Instead, like it had in the past, the hotel served as a mobster meeting place and a landmark for celebrities to rub shoulders with famous mobsters and lavish parties where every vice could be catered for. Now, as I said earlier, after the death of the founding father of the Paglieri family, Salvatore Paglieri, Vittorio Gianelli took control of the family, running business directly from his suite in the Overlook Hotel. I won't dig too deep into the situation too much today because we will be doing a major deep dive on a certain mob family and the New York Mafia scene a little later in the year. What I will say is that the blue-collar criminals of the Paglieri family got sick of playing second fiddle to Gianelli and his snobby stockbrokers. In 1967, angry having been passed over by his father for his less qualified uncle-in-law, George Paglieri organized, with the approval of the commission, to take down Gianelli, who had begun to refer to himself as the boss of all bosses, a cardinal sin in a time after the commission had abolished the title back in the 30s. So, on August 8, 1967, as Gianelli and his two bodyguards exited the elevator on the ground floor of the Overlook lobby, they were brutally gunned down by six masked men brandishing old-school Tommy guns. This was overkill at its finest, as all six men reloaded their guns six times, shooting the bodies on six separate occasions in unison. Basically, six, six, six.
Sorry.
Yeah, you're right, it's...
Six men, six reloads, six shootings. Like a sign from the Overlook, maybe.
That's what I was going to get at myself. I see you were about to say it as well, so I'd let you say it. But yeah, pretty much that's a sign of things to come here.
Yeah.
You know, a dark sign. I mean, and for them to do that, they must have seen something in the Overlook. There must have been some rumors at that stage as well. I haven't read any rumors at that stage, but yeah. After this murder, police, ATF and the FBI agents swarmed and searched the Overlook, leading to a huge trial against the leaders of the commission and seeing countless Mafia soldiers and associates take convictions and do some time. The Overlook was confiscated by the government and auctioned off to another investor group who kept the hotel closed until 1969 for minor maintenance and renovation. Because to DeWine's credit, despite not making a penny from it, he designed one of the most aesthetically pleasing hotels ever in existence. Right, that's the history of the hotel up until the 70s. So now we get into the ghosty shit.
Finally.
You've been waiting for this.
Absolutely.
So do you know who Lorraine Massey is?
I love Lorraine Massey.
Well, Lorraine Massey, what, was it Lorraine or Lorena? Lorraine, isn't it?
I had my hand on my throat when I was speaking, okay, so it came out Lorena.
She was an American child actress and singer. She attained international stardom and critical acclaim as an actress in both musical and dramatic roles, as a recording artist and on the concert stage. Renowned for her versatility, she received a Golden Globe Award, a Special Tony Award, and was one of 12 in history to receive an Academy Juvenile Award. Massey struggled, though, in her personal life from an early age. The pressure of early stardom affected her physical and mental health from the time she was a teenager. Her self-image was influenced by constant criticism from film execs who believed that she was physically unattractive and who manipulated her on-screen physical appearance. She had financial troubles, often owing hundreds of thousands of dollars in back taxes. Throughout her adulthood, she struggled with substance use disorder involving both drugs and alcohol. As she aged, years of abuse began to show. Surviving on royalty checks and an elderly, rich, high-powered lawyer husband's checkbook, Massey continued to live her lavish and destructive lifestyle well into her 50s. When the Overlook reopened, she was a regular guest, usually accompanied by a strapping young lad young enough to be her son and in later years her grandson. In 1970, on the weekend of her 54th birthday, a haggard-looking Massey arrived at the Overlook with a new up-and-coming Calvin Klein male model. This weekend happened to coincide with a pharmaceutical convention being held in the lavish hotel function room known as the Gold Room. Basically, there was a bunch of good-looking women trying to sell new drugs to doctors.
Okay.
That night, when work was over, the medical practitioners and salespeople were out to play, and unfortunately for Lorraine, her beau had eyes for a younger, wilder model. Oh. Leaving Lorraine to drink alone at the bar as he left with a few girls to attend a private party in one of the doctor's luxury suites. This for Lorraine was her rock bottom. Her career was long over, her looks were fading, and the one thing that made her marriage bearable was her steamy weekends away with younger men, and now even that was gone. Desperate, depressed, and defeated, Lorraine Massey finished her drink, went back to room 217, ran a warm bath, then consumed a bottle of 60 Valium as she drank red wine straight from the bottle. She was found in her bath the next morning by housekeeping. Cause of death is officially drowning.
What about the 60 pills, though?
High power lawyer husband, remember? He didn't need the scandal of a drug addicted wife dying of suicide because her toy boy ditched her.
Yeah, yeah.
So Stuart Ullman, manager of the Overlook since its reopening, went along with the story, and the true story of Lorraine Massey went down as just an urban legend. It's only the testimony of the maid who found the body and other guests who saw her open drug use and alcohol consumption that we have the story we have today. People who have stayed in room 217 have constantly complained of having terrifying dreams and from hearing noises coming from the bathroom, like a glass bottle smashing on a tile floor or the taps turning themselves on and off. The creepiest of the stories is that if you watch from the front door of the room, you can see into the bathroom, which is directly across the room from the main door. So if you're standing at the main door and you look in the main door and the bathroom door is open, you can see the bathtub.
Okay.
They say if you stand at the main door and stare at the bat long enough, that you'll see the shower curtain slowly begin to creep open.
And what's behind it when it opens?
No one can ever say, because they say they get filled with fucking fear and run for their life. They don't know what they're running from, but they know they need to run.
Out. Okay.
So no one has ever actually been able, no staff member has ever actually been able to stay long enough to see what happens. Some people say it's an optical illusion. Some people say that it's just a case of, you know, you stare at something long enough
and it looks like it's moving.
But the slightest twitch and they all went running. Yeah. One guy who did say something about it, who we're going to talk more about next week, is Danny Torrance. And he said that when he ran from it for the first time, it felt like the hotel was trying to grab him, to get him, to consume him, to draw him in, to make him one with the Creepy. Overlook Hotel. But we'll talk more about Danny and his dad next week.
Okay,
it's honesty time. We have a confession to make. We suck at socials. No good at Insta. Can't send a tweet or an X or whatever that super villain looking motherfucker is calling it now. Stick to your space cars, Elon. But we know ye want to chat. You want to be kept updated. You want to be alive all the goddamn time. So we're getting down from the anti-social soapbox and giving this a try. So come chat to us on Insta and Twitter at AliveAlivePod or hit us up by email at itsAliveAlivePod@gmail.com. We want to hear from you. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. This is a project. It's still a work in progress and we just want to give you more what you like and less of what you can't stand. So give us a like, give us a follow. We'll always hit you back and we'll always try to reply to everyone. So come say hi. We don't bite. Well, at least Amy doesn't. And she keeps me well fed, so you got nothing to worry about. Now, back to the show!
So we just kind of alluded to who we'll be talking about next week, and they were the caretakers of the Overlook in 77, I believe. I don't have that number directly in front of me. But before we get into that, we're going to talk about another caretaker of the Overlook Hotel. Because it seems to be a cursed role. And this man is called Delbert Grady. And he's going to be our last story of today before we get into the Torrances next week. So little is known of Delbert Grady's early life. Just that he grew up in London and came from a family of high-end servants. A trade he also followed into once reaching working age. Actually, call back to an earlier episode, Delbert Grady worked for Frank Saville. Do you remember him? From the Von Strum Revenge Massacre.
Yeah.
We covered it in episode 26.
Yeah.
Grady, a lifelong alcoholic, eventually lost his job and immigrated to the States, but not before meeting and marrying Shelley King, a maid of the Savilles who quit when Delbert was left go.
Why did she go if he was a raging alcoholic?
At this point, he was a functioning alcoholic and he was, you know, the life of the party. He could be very charismatic, so it was disguisable. It was kind of, I think it was Frank Saville just kind of saw through the fucking haze of it eventually. And then we go. He had high standards, as we remember from our Von Sturm? Series. But once in America, away from the comfort of home and the support of family, the pressure of no work and the drinking began to show on Delbert, who began to regularly beat his wife. It wasn't until Shelley fell pregnant with twins that Delbert made any attempt to clean up his act, refusing to give up but cutting back on his drinking and putting back on the mask of the elegant gentleman servant. It was with this image that he landed the job in the Overlook Hotel as he impressed Don Gianelli and his love of the finer things and way of life. I mean, despite his faults, Grady was a very good butler. Grady worked primarily as a caretaker, but his civilized manner, etiquette, and training meant he was regularly called on to act as a waiter at elegant parties or a personal caretaker to some of the more elite guests. But during the winter, it was just Grady, his family, and Grady's best friend, the Overlook bar manager, Lloyd Sullivan. Sullivan had no family of his own, so each winter he and Grady would stay behind as caretakers, maintaining, repairing, and preparing the hotel for the next summer season. The two were inseparable. Being an alcoholic, Grady spent most of his off time sitting at the Overlook bar, chatting about all sorts of everything with Lloyd. In later diaries, we would read that Lloyd was one of the few people Grady would open up to, and despite being the facilitator of his habit, Lloyd was working hard with Grady to wean him off the alcohol and into a program. Things were going good too, until one night after a particularly bad fight with Shelley, Grady went on a bender. He said Lloyd and him had got into a fight and Lloyd left. Remember, this is the dead of winter now.
Yeah.
Grady said Lloyd regularly went into the world famous Overlook Hotel hedge maze to think and just collect himself. Grady claimed Lloyd knew the maze like the back of his hand and he would never get lost in there.
But he did, like, right?
Yeah. No, he didn't get lost so much as he froze to death before he could get back out. He was found frozen in the fetal position right in the center of the maze.
Ooh.
Obviously, Grady blamed himself and his drinking, but instead of dealing with the problem, he doubled down. It was then he began to talk to people who weren't there. In fact, the diary he kept was actually filled with letters to Lloyd written post-mortem. Not post-mortem for Grady, but for Lloyd. He spoke in the letters as if Lloyd was right in front of him. The most startling information in these letters, though, was his state of mind. He commented on how his family were acting strange, how his daughter looked at him funny, daughters even looked at him funny now, how his wife accused him of sitting at the bar alone all night when clearly he had been there with Lloyd. He said the hotel guests were getting annoyed by their behaviour and that it was time that he corrected them accordingly.
How do you mean guests? I thought all this was happening in the off-season.
It was. But he insisted the hotel was booked to capacity and he was receiving complaint after complaint in regards to his wife and the unruly twin girls.
Okay.
For months, Grady became more and more volatile and more abusive towards his wife. Punishments for even the smallest infractions came hard and swift when either of the girls stepped out of line as well. In a suicide note left by Grady, he claims it all came to a head on January 1st, 1975, when the twins Lisa and Louise tried to burn the hotel down by causing the old boiler in the basement to explode. Back then, one of Grady's jobs was to release the pressure valve on the boiler, releasing the pressure and preventing an explosion. Not the greatest of models, but for its time.
Yeah.
The twins made sure to tighten the valve almost as soon as their father had left the boiler room and had been doing so for days, slowly building up the pressure on the ancient machine. When Grady figured out what had happened, he snapped. He wrote that the guests and Lloyd agreed with him and that this infraction deserved the most severest of punishments. With that, Grady took an axe and went to the family quarters, where he found his wife. Using the axe, he hacked her into tiny pieces, placed her in her dismembered corpse into a refuse sack, and carried her over to room 217. There, he spread her parts in their correct anatomical position across the bed. He then went to find the twins, who he found cowering in the basement. He dragged them by their hair from the basement up 3 flights of stairs, then in front of their mother's dismembered body, took turns hacking at them, first taking each of their arms, then each of their legs, before finally their heads. He then stacked their bodies neatly in the hall, almost as if to leave them out for housekeeping to take his trash away. He then sat in room 217, poured a whiskey, wrote his suicide note, drank his final drink with a fine Cuban cigar, and blew his brains out. The badly decomposed bodies wouldn't be found for 3 months when the snow finally began to thaw and the local rangers did their annual wellness check. The diary of Delbert Grady and the murder of his family was put down to stress, alcoholism and cabin fever, and the case was quickly put to bed. The Overlook opened its doors as usual only 6 weeks later with 2 new rules. No staff was to speak of Delbert Grady ever again, and no alcohol was to be left in the Overlook Hotel during the off-season, meaning all winter caretakers from this point on would do the job completely sober for the whole 6 months. The Overlook Hotel stayed in business until 1977 after the Torrance family incident would see it finally shut its doors for good and would stand as a ghostly shrine for 36 years until, like a prophecy fulfilled, the Overlook Hotel would burn to the ground after the old boiler was powered up again and put under enough pressure to cause an explosion. But we'll get into all that, the Torrance family, and much, much more next week on the Overlook Hotel Part 2. Until then, you know what to do. Follow us on socials at Alive Alive Pod and check out our Patreon at It's Alive Alive Pod for great shows like our true crime show Real Monsters and Amy's great history podcast Blow It Play My Bones, along with classic episodes of Behind the Mask and early access to Creepy Craft Past the Crypt and Mini Monsters. I'm running out of breath here.
All that, and you get ad-free access to our main show and the weekend update, all for just £5 a month or dollars or you whatever. That on Patreon at It's Alive Alive Pod.
And now you get a 7-day free trial to go with that. You before you even spend your $5, you can test it for 7 days. And if you like it, then you can spend the $5 on it. So, I mean, can't get a better deal than that. We'll be back next Wednesday with more tales from the horrorverse. It's the Live Alive Podcast. All the guts and gore with none of the guilt. See you all next time. Same Alive Lifetime, same horrorverse channel. Okay, love you. Bye-bye.
Really love you. Bye-bye. Whew.